Hey there, this is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome. I am Michael Shaw. This is episode 289 with Katarina Wong, part one of two. She is an artist, writer, curator based in New York City, though currently living in Santa Fe during the pandemic and working remotely. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see an image of Katarina in an installation, a couple of her curatorial efforts, a couple pieces of her work. And next round, you will see a lot more representing Cuba, including the renovation that she's doing there. More on her and the episodes in a moment. I want to tell you about the upcoming virtual cafe. I'm going to tell you about a podcast I've been listening to. And, of course, going to throw out some thank yous and whatnot. Yeah, so let's get to the cafe. The next virtual cafe is Saturday, March 13 at 11:30 a.m. Pacific time. So do the math. It's going to be with another special guest, Lee Wagstaff, who is a former guest of the show. And I really wanted to have him on to talk about his artist support pledge efforts or his campaign. And we talked, of course, with Matthew Burrows, who started Artist Support Pledge. He is an English artist. Lee is an English artist, but living in Berlin for quite a while. Very curious to hear about how that Artist Support Pledge that he's been doing ongoing is going, and some other things as well. And definitely want you, the listener who shows up, to get involved in that as well, in whatever way that you want to engage in that conversation. So again, Saturday the 13th at 11:30 Pacific time. And if you're not already on the email list, you can just go to theconversationpod.com, hover over the contact part of the menu, and you will see Virtual Cafe, and you can sign up, sign on. I want to send out a big thank you to those of you who have continued to support the show via Patreon. Many thanks to you guys. Really appreciate it. Big thank you to Allison Widows, Van Cacinero, Lydia Kegler, and Angela Groom for their contributions. Thanks to all of you. And if you would like to support the show, there are a couple of different ways you can do it. You can do so by going to theconversationpod.com/support, and you can support us via Patreon, one time via Venmo or PayPal or old-fashioned check. Just reach out. Yeah, and if you do support via Patreon, that's an ongoing way to support the show for as little as a dollar a month, though certainly five or more a month is very much appreciated. And again, really does help the show keep going. So thank you so much again to those of you who do support via Patreon and otherwise. And if you haven't yet, you know, maybe now would be a good time. If you can't afford it, I totally understand. Other ways you can support the show is you can leave a great review on our Apple Podcast page or Stitcher, or if you listen elsewhere, Google Play. And then you can spread the word about the show. And you can follow us on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram, or me at Michael Shaw Art. Thank you in advance. Yeah, so that's pretty much for the regular announcements. I just thought I would tell you briefly about this podcast that I was introduced to by friend of the show, Doug Burns, who's a regular participant in the virtual cafes. He introduced me to the podcast. I asked people in the virtual cafe, what podcast have you guys been listening to? Long story short, I have become a big fan of the one he recommended. It's called No Dogs in Space. And it is a show that they're calling their first season about punk. Let me see if I can do that without popping the P. Punk, the history and origins, particularly via all of the various bands, a lot of the big bands that they feel are seminal, both pre, during, and I don't think they're really getting into post, but definitely pre and during punk. So far I've listened to a 4-part episode with the Stooges, of course, the seminal pre-punk band, and then 4 episodes with the Damned, which I knew pretty much nothing about. So that's been interesting, although I definitely reject the premise that the hosts make. And the hosts are great, by the way, that the Damned are far superior in many ways to the Sex Pistols. Though the Sex Pistols had a very short career and discography, I still think their music is more iconic and ultimately better than the Best of the Damned, for what it's worth. Anyway, I also listened to Sid and Nancy. That's a one-off episode. And then just started The Ramones, which is a four-parter. There's going to be a four-parter with Joy Division, a three-parter with The Slits, which I'm super excited about. And guess who has five parts devoted to them? I don't think you're going to get this, but go ahead. Take a stab. Give up. The Dead Kennedys. Five part episode. And these episodes are like up to 2 hours. Many of them average around an hour and a half. Five parts devoted to the Dead Kennedys. And I know Jello Biafra, the notorious frontman leader, ran for mayor of San Francisco, I believe, at one point. So you can imagine there's a lot to talk about. But above even all of those other bands, five episodes devoted to them is super intriguing. So all that to say that it's nice having a podcast where you can kind of dive into like a great novel, and you're just like, I just want this to keep going on, and I don't need to listen to other podcasts except The Conversation, of course. All right, so lastly, before we jump in, Katarina, what such a great conversation, and you know when it's a two-part episode that just like these four- and five-part No Dogs in Space episodes, that is, you got great stuff. And indeed, the first episode, we got into some great conversation around one's relationship to their day job and their art and that balance. And what is the perfect balance? Is it necessarily having a career in which you just get to make work all the time? Or maybe is that the grass is always greener type situation? We also talk a little bit about Cuba, which we will talk a lot more about in the second episode. And we're also going to talk about her other projects, including a artist introduction type project. But this one, we talk a lot about being an artist, having a full-time job. She worked in corporate world and curated in the corporate world for a while. So one more thing that I almost forgot before we jump in. We do talk a bit about the P word, certainly at least refer to it. For those of you who still don't know, because you haven't caught any of the episodes where it's come up, or maybe it's only been mentioned as a reference but not explained, I have had this vendetta against the P word, as in not going to soccer practice, but my art P word, as I call it, the P word. And I actually just did a little piece about it. Hopefully you don't hate that word piece, but I just did a short piece about the P word for Visual Art Source, which I write for pretty regularly. And it's gone out in the newsletter today, but won't be up on the website for a bit. So if you are interested, I can forward that newsletter to you, and I'll post it when it goes up on their webpage. But all that to say that it's called My Battle Against the P Word, and it's a short piece. It gives you a little bit of context and explanation as to my gripes with it. And I know, yes, some people are definitely, more than once, people have said, get over yourself or get over it. And others have been sympathetic. And I guess most people are kind of quizzical or, oh, okay. Anyway, we refer to it briefly in our conversation, Katarina and I. And so that's what it's about. That's what it's referring to. All right. All that coming up. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you guys are doing well. Hope some of you are getting vaccinated. I've been trying, but have failed to procure an appointment. So good luck with that. And thank you for listening. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, be well. So Katarina, you are, let's see, I mean, where do we start? So you are, I just want to do a quick summary for us, if not for listeners. You are a New York-based artist and multi-hyphenate, but you spent a lot of time in Cuba, and currently you are sort of pandemic homing in Santa Fe. Which of that should we talk about first? You've been in New York a pretty long time. I know that.
Yeah.
When you are in New York, what part of New York are you in?
Well, I was in Chelsea for a long time, and then I moved up to West Harlem in a neighborhood called Hamilton Heights about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's part of that is I'm really close to where I work, and that makes it easy.
Right, right. And where do you work?
I work at Teachers College at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm. And previous to that, I know you had a little bit of a part of your career, stretch of your career was in a more of a corporate environment. Is that fair?
That's right. Yeah.
Can you talk about that for a little bit? I mean,
sure.
And the subtext I get, I think, to help sort of contextualize this is that it seems, just from the little that we've got to know each other, that you have had some pretty serious, and do even still have a pretty serious day job, you know, in addition to all the other projects you're doing. So, I mean, do you feel like in retrospect that that's something that was intentional, or it, you know, it just kind of happened, or how do you see that part of your history?
Oh, sure. Well, definitely not intentional.
Okay.
But so I moved to New York City in 2001, January 2001. Mm-hmm. And I had to hit the ground running. I had just come off of a visiting professor gig at the University of Iowa for 3 semesters. And when my contract was up, it was for me now or never. I'd always wanted to be in New York. I had a lot of friends in New York and visited a lot. And so that was a perfect time. And I came and I needed to find, an apartment, hopefully with a studio and a job to support myself and all of that good stuff, like right away. So I did what I have done in the past when I really just needed to get into work for as quickly as I got a temp job. And they sent me to I had no idea about this. It was one of the largest global communications firms. And I didn't know anything about public relations. I honestly had no idea what that meant. And so I was just doing basic administrative stuff, and I was there for 3 months, and it was fine. It was paying my bills, and it was the kind of job that like I could leave. You know, I could work my 8 hours and then just go home and be in my studio.
Mm-hmm.
So they offered me a full-time position, and it was funny because like that was the first time they actually saw my resume, and they were like, "Wait, what? You have a master's degree in fine arts and a master's degree in theological studies? Like, what?" And I was like, "Yeah, just pay me so I can go do my work and my real work." But I was there. I left in 2014. So I was there for 13 years. And over that time, the person I was working for, was kind of moving up in the ranks, and I was moving up with him. So I went mm-hmm. from administrative assistant to eventually a vice president, director
wow.
of community and curatorial engagement. And it was kind of a job that I had seen some opportunity, and I pitched it to them. By this point, they knew what I could do. They knew what my strong points were, and I made a case for why this job position was necessary. And it really built on my strengths. They had moved to a new location, so I was able to be part of the design committee. I curated I started and curated a collection for them to have in the office, as well as a temporary a gallery space where I could do rotating shows, as well as do a lot of internal facing programs for our, at that point, close to 800, by the time I left, I think it was close to 800 employees. So it became this really interesting job that I honestly never had any desire
right.
to do prior to coming to New York. I didn't, those kinds of jobs are the kinds of things that never existed, first of all, when I was in school. And I'm really, as much as like, I'll be really transparent about it. I working in a corporate job has its pluses and minuses, and it's tough. It is definitely, can be very tough. But the skill set I took away from that, just in terms of business-wise, is something that has just paid off for me. and I never would have gotten it otherwise.
Right, right. That's a huge bonus. So clarify, did you actually sort of invent a curatorial position then? You became a curator there?
Kind of, yeah. Because it was part of like the conversations we were having about when we were moving to a new space of, mm-hmm. You know, what do we want on our walls? What do
right.
we want our environment to look like, to feel like? What do we want it to inspire in the people that work here and also people who want to work here, and importantly, also the clients who want. Like when you walk into an office, it tells you so much about the culture and the character
yeah.
of that company. And so I basically kind of, what if we did this? You know, what if I curated a collection of work? It's not just from artists, but, you know, from information scientists, from, you know, graphic designers, you know, just around different ideas of communication and what that, and playing with that idea. And so it's, you know, it became something that was a lot of fun and actually pushed me out of my comfort zone, which is always kind of good. It's not scary. And
yeah.
along with that, you know, there were these other things that kind of meshed at the same time with what we could be doing for internally for our staff.
Mm-hmm. I imagine as you're describing that, you know, coming onto that position or creating it and coming into it, that one of the things that I can't help but wonder about is that you're an artist who's becoming a bona fide curator, you know, with a big budget, presumably, and a lot of space, you know, to put that work. Did you either at the time or in retrospect see it in a way through a lens of like power or you know what I mean, freedom, kind of all of the above? Was it head spinning in some ways at all?
I might say none of the above.
Okay.
So one of the things about most corporations is like, if you can't prove a tangible return on investment, you do not get the big budget. So
okay. This
was not, I'll just be very clear, this was not like, oh, let's start a Saatchi kind of collection. It was not
right.
about that at all.
Right.
So, you know, it was a good size budget, but it was not a huge budget by any means. And, you know, I think, you know, I don't know about power, but I had been, the reason I was able to make the case for this is I had already been curating projects on the side as an independent curator that were really coming out of my own practice as an artist. Like I was really interested in how other artists were dealing with topics or themes or ideas that I was playing with in the studio. And, you know, so actually that was one of the first, that's an early thing I started doing when I got to New York, because it was also secondarily a wonderful way to meet other artists and have great conversations with them in their
yeah.
studios about this thing that they're most passionate about. And so, you know, I don't think I would have been successful in pitching this idea to the company, like, oh, let's have this art collection, if they didn't know I was already doing this on the side, that I had experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But what do you mean you had to show them a return on investment? In other words, they were going to check back in a couple of years and see how the value of the works that you selected were doing, or what kind of situation?
No, it wasn't that. I think it's not that kind of situation. I think it's like, you know, there are certain positions in any company, not just this particular company, but that, you know, it's very obvious, like, you know, I have brought in this amount of revenue, this kind of, you know, over the time I'm here, and it's very month to month. You can see. With positions like mine, which were not client facing, there's definitely a value to them, but it's hard to quantify.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the stickiness of it comes into, I think, is that you can't use the dollar as a metric in some ways,
mm-hmm.
but when you're dealing with finance people and trying to justify, you know, your budgets every year, you have to find a way to talk about it at least.
Right.
And so that's just a really, can be a very tricky situation to be in.
Yeah. Did having the curatorial part of your work change your perspective on having a day job? Because I mean, before it seems like for doing it for that long, was it full time when you worked for that company?
Yes, it was definitely full time.
Yeah. So I mean, was that did yeah, that so, get to be
yeah,
draining?
Yeah, went from like 9 to 5 to like all you know, like kind of on call. Yeah.
Mm. So I mean, the reason I'm asking just is because I'm trying to get a sense of how much that took over both your time and or your self-identity as well.
Yeah. So that was, you know, that's another tricky part of what being in the corporate atmosphere is that especially the higher up you go and the more they pay you, the more they are expecting your time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I became very efficient about like at the end of the day, I could go to my studio and boom, hit the ground running. And
right.
like, even if I only had an hour or two, I could get stuff done. I will say that is not my favorite way of being in the studio, but it was the way that I could be in the studio at that time. You know, I would much rather like have a whole afternoon to futz and putz and maybe I get the same amount of work done. But you know, I got very good at managing my time. But it was always, I think pretty much almost every day that there was this thought in the back of my head of like, what would happen if I didn't have my day job and just could be an artist? And you know, like, and then you start seeing, you know, like maybe some of your friends or other people you know about who are fortunate enough to be full-time artists or not have to worry about not have the same kind of financial constraints, and so they are able to be in their studio. And you know, I never resented them. I just I actually saw folks like that as kind of like, that's what I want. You know, one day I want that. That seems really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you didn't resent them, but didn't you have a little bit of envy at least?
Oh yeah. No, major envy.
Okay.
Major
good.
Envy. but no saint here, but definitely didn't resent them. I wasn't like someone
right.
like, oh wow. You know, but
yeah.
like, yeah.
yeah,
this is actually, I feel that way. I feel like artists should be valued that way. We should be, you know, it shouldn't be so hard to exist
right.
and make your work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you were in this corporate job, and is it, how would you characterize your sort of your day job or your career outside of your being an artist before and since then? I mean, you've been in academia, right? Were you in academia
yeah.
before that job too?
Yeah. So right before that, the job I had before then was I was a visiting professor at the University of Iowa, which was a really sweet deal. Basically, I taught two classes, two lovely students, you know, and they gave me a studio and they gave me a living wage and I had health care and all that good stuff. And in some ways, one of my best friends is the one that recommended me for the job. So she lived in town. So I, you know, it was one of the times where I look back and I'm like, gosh, in terms of like that elusive work-life balance, this was pretty sweet.
Right.
And so I also, the nice part of it is because I wasn't tenure tracked, I didn't have to do any of the committee work or any of that kind of stuff. So I really had a lot of time in my studio and also time to devote to teaching, which I loved doing. When I got to New York and had to take a corporate job, it was, I think, the first time in my life that I actually worked a 9-to-5 full-time job year round. And it was the first summer that hit, I was like almost physically and emotionally, mentally, I was like, okay, I'll see you in September. Like there was this part of me was like, wait, what? I have to work the summer too. It was, it was like kind of like a little bit of a rude awakening. Like, oh
yeah.
this is how it goes. And you know, yeah. So, but after that job, eventually my position was eliminated and I was downsized and I was in a position And again, this is a really wonderful plus of the corporate side is that I had been able to save money and I had an exit package. And I did for the first time have time and funding to be what I'd been fantasizing about all this time, to really be a full-time artist.
Right. Right. So why did the Iowa job end? Did you decide it was time, or did they, or what happened?
Oh, it was always a visiting.
It was a year, was it? 2 years?
It was a year, and then they extended me for, they invited me to stay another semester, which is why I stayed for 3 semesters and moved to New York in January. Yeah.
If you had been, let's just pretend, do a little exercise. If you were offered, say, a tenure track position there, do you think you would have taken it?
I actually was, you know, when I was there, I was looking at tenure track positions and was hired for one at a different university that I turned down. And why I turned it down now in hindsight is kind of hazy because it was a long time ago, but it just didn't feel right. And had it been at Iowa, I might have said yes because I was so comfortable there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, teaching and if you're lucky enough to have a tenure track job teaching, that's just an amazing path as well. But, you know, like any job that you're balancing with creative work, there's pluses and minuses. And I just think everyone just needs to be really mindful and aware about what those pluses and minuses are. And if those align with your values and with what you can do and what you can live with and what you can't live with.
Yeah. The thing that keeps coming back is, you know, that grass is always greener cliche. You know, I mean, almost no matter what, you know, because even, you know, for the longest time and so many of us artists, the most end we have is for the full-time artists that are consistently selling, you know, and keeping their careers going that way. But there is the pressure that some people have talked
about.
I don't know if I've actually heard that description from any of those people, unfortunately, or at least not that I can remember, but that's certainly one that I've heard on more than one occasion.
I'm really glad you brought that up because you're reminding me, when I got to New York, I was accepted into a program called Artists in the Marketplace that's offered through the Bronx Museum of Art.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal program, which it really does show, like, you know, unfortunately, most art grad schools do not have a business side program, you know, like courses that they teach, which is just so important. And this was really about, you know, everything from like how you put an artist statement together and a package of images together to who doing the research of who and how to approach galleries or other organizations that might be amenable to your work and grant writing, all that stuff. And we went to visit an artist as that I would have described just like you did, like someone who is like got the gallery, is selling, showing in museums, you know, like what everyone in that room wanted.
Right.
And then he started talking about how to complete a project. And it wasn't that long, you know, prior to this kind of like how he had to max out his credit cards and just hope that he would sell out a show and this pressure to do this. And I was like, oh, that had never occurred to me.
Right.
Like that, you know, that there was going to be this side of being a full-time professional artist that it was going to be not fun or kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was this kind of myth of the artist, you know, that, you know, whatever blue chip artist that has, you know, legions of galleries and gallerists working for them so that to insulate them from having to do all that stuff. And that exists, but it's such a small percentage.
Yeah.
But it's sold as a dream.
Right.
And what happens is, at least what I see is that it really messes you up when you start thinking of yourself as an artist and like, how do I define success for myself?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
who do you think is selling that dream?
So Such a good question, right?
Yeah. Maybe we're selling it to ourselves.
We're absolutely, I think, artists, well, if we're not selling it to ourselves, we are certainly drinking that Kool-Aid.
Yeah, right.
And that's not the, you know, I have an MFA, and I think MFAs are, there's definitely some value to them.
Speaking of, that's a great segue, speaking of master's degrees and prestigious universities, so you went, after your MFA, you went back to school and got a master's in theology, is that right? Theological studies?
Yeah, theological studies, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the story there? What made you head in that direction?
Oh, pretty much like everything in my life, pretty much serendipity. Or
right.
So I was, after I got my MFA, and I was living in the D.C. Baltimore area and showing my work, and I was really interested in this question of, like, how do you talk about what for me is like a non-language-based question, or like of activity. So for me, like when I'm in the studio making work, I feel like a different part of my brain is working that's not in a language center. And, you know, everybody has different experiences, but that was mine. So I started thinking, like, this is interesting. Like, how do you use language to share this experience to a larger audience who is not having that experience? And I happened to be reading a lot of contemporary Buddhist writers at the time, and I realized, oh, actually, Buddhism has a whole library about this, maybe not about art, but talking about the enlightenment process, which is definitely mm-hmm. not language-based. And mm-hmm. I thought, it might be kind of like, what do I do with that? As I was kind of thinking about this, I happened to go to an artist residency, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and I'm reconnected with another resident there who, Soihan Bay, she and I had been in Skowhegan together years prior, and we were just so delighted to see each other. And she, turns out she was at the Harvard Divinity School working on something else, and we literally sat down and we were just like blah 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 chat. It was like for 4 hours, and by mm-hmm. the end of that conversation, you know, like she had been like listening to what I've been talking about and said, you need to apply. Mm-hmm. And she planted that seed, and I was, you know, at first I was like, that's crazy, I'm not going to Harvard, you know, what? And mm-hmm. it just kind of, I let it just sit there, and it grew, and I honestly, I didn't tell anyone I applied because I was so sure I wasn't going to get in. Hmm. And then I did, and ended up taking a couple years off to think about Buddhism.
Uh-huh. So you can really probably much better address what it means to be Zen than most of us so casually do on a regular basis, right?
I don't know about that. I don't know how good a Buddhist I am, but
Well, it's funny, you know, I've been writing this piece, and I've been writing this piece about the P word, I guess I should just say. And I was looking back to this email that this guy wrote me because, you know, I had mentioned it to him too. And he said, does anybody ever think of, just give me a second because I'd actually want to quote it exactly if you bear with me. He said, has anyone ever talked about practice, not like a legal practice sense, but in the Buddhist sense of always trying and never achieving? That's mm-hmm. sort of how I think about it. So, you know, yeah. I mean, when you put it that way, I think that's a pretty beautiful way, you know, to pursue things, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if artists, when they use the P word, or I don't think they're usually doing that, but because I think there's much more production, than that kind of thing. But anyway, but I don't want to get off into what I was doing. I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, of Buddhism. Do you, to what extent, if you don't mind my asking, does that enter your art making perspective?
Actually, yeah, I'm on like camp practice side in terms mm-hmm. of using that word. Mm-hmm. But definitely, I guess I hadn't thought of it as another way, you know, any other way other than the kind of practice I do when I sit on a cushion. You know, this mm-hmm. idea of like, engaging wholeheartedly in an activity, and actually trying to safeguard myself against the idea of like, oh, it's gonna, you know, like towards a definite end or
right.
a finished project. Of course, I mean, all of us are, you know, if we're making work, we want to finish our work, but
yeah.
that's not the necessarily the overarching goal. It's this experience.
That's the crux of what my sort of ongoing challenge is, or at least my question is around, you know, how we think about our work. I mean, we're just so conditioned. And maybe this is what some of what you learned, how you learned about the other way of seeing or thinking in Buddhism. But, you know, we're so conditioned to come up with something finished. You know, is there even room to mess around? I mean, people talk a lot about messing around or experimenting or playing or what have you, you know, but ultimately, you know, you go a little bit further down the road, there is, you know, somebody waiting to collect the bill, right? If you will, whatever metaphor you want to use, you know what I mean? It's like eventually there, you know, you got to pay or you know, you got to deliver, right? You can't do that indefinitely in the arena that we have currently in existence that I can think of.
Yeah, I guess that's where I think that is probably very true within, if we're talking about the art world or that system of galleries and showing and achievement that way, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, if you choose just to play, to embrace that part of your work, or your methodology, if you embrace it too much and if you are not producing enough, you fall off the radar, right?
Yeah.
Or, but I also don't, you know, I actually want to challenge this that's the only way of going about it. And, you know, and I'm also saying this as someone who shows her work, I love selling my work. I love getting it into the world rather than in my storage unit but at the time, you know, I have a very ambivalent relationship to it because I do wholeheartedly believe that if I wanted just to be into something for production, I would be, I don't know, a stockbroker, you know, or something. Like I would be doing something that would be a lot more financially remunerative and actually, you know, creating a product that everybody wants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, there are the realities of it. So I really don't know what the answer is, except that I feel like maybe I'm doing a dance between that and whatever else there is in which I really am trying to focus. When I'm making work, I'm just trying to stay in that space of just being in dialogue with that process of making the work.
Mm-hmm.
And not try to think of like, oh, who's going to like it? Or
that's right.
Who should I show this to?
That's
like,
it.
You know,
yeah.
That, and let that be, you know, once the work I feel like is coming, you know, I'm finished with it, that then there's this other thing that to me is like a clear delineation in the sand.
Right.
That I try not to let come into my making space.
Right.
I'm really trying to avoid the word practice.
Yeah, thank you. I think you really helped me, I think, come to sort of a place where I really think the juice lives, if you will. It's about getting to a place where, and maybe this is the Buddhism effect to some extent, that you're want to get to this place where you can be in that space without all the noise. And I don't think that's something I, at least for myself, think about anywhere near enough, you know, barely at all, in fact. And I would project that that's the case with more artists than not, that they're not really thinking about getting into that space where they can push out the noise of other people's expectations, or, you know, in fact, I remember talking to somebody, I don't remember who it was, and that's not important, but I remember somebody talking about making a work with one person in mind. You know, like, just think think of this one, what will this one person think of this work? So there's a model right there that, you know, even if it's only one person, it's still, you know, you're not working in this sort of playing around, you know.
Right.
Working within your own internal language, you're actually sort of performing, even if it's for whether it's for a real person or a fictitious person. You know, you're still kind of ultimately,
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I talk about it, but like it is hard because, you know, we are all conditioned with, you know, first our parents' voices in our heads and then our teachers' voices and then our peers and then, you know, it spirals out, right? And I think part of why, you know, I still want to make work is there are these moments of just pure dialogue with this thing that wants to come into the world, for lack of a better way. And that space is just so electric and intoxicating to me. It's just it's just such a beautiful space to be in that, and I don't always feel it when I go into the studio or sit down to write or whatever, but when I can kind of get lost in it, that's where I'm like, oh, this is why I'm not a stockbroker. This is why I'm not XYZ, right? Because I have this moment that is completely outside of consideration of any sort of return on investment or financial or obligation or meeting anybody else's expectation. You know, it is a, and I guess I kind of, and what that's what keeps me going back into the studio is wanting another hit of that. But I agree, it's not an easy space to maintain because of all the conditioning we have.
Right. I can't help but wonder, you know, I mentioned that you have spent a lot of time in Cuba. You have a Cuban mother, is it? Right?
Yes.
Yeah. To what extent have you experienced artists that you've met in Cuba who maybe because of being cut off, you know, if they're old enough to have, you know, experienced a big part of that era, that they see things differently in this regard, that what we're talking about, you know, like if they are less, you know, sort of overwhelmed by the market and, you know, production and so on, that they do get to, you know, because maybe at one point, certainly a number of Cuban artists are working in a place where they're cut off, and the benefit of that is that their stakes are maybe low, or, you know, they're not, I don't know. You see where I'm going. What do you think?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because, you know, I guess I had made some of those assumptions too. And a few years ago when I really started spending more time in Cuba, 2015, when, you know, I would go every other year to see family, but in 2015, when President Obama started to open up our relations again with Cuba, I started spending a lot more time there and really trying to make connections in the art world there, just because I was curious as well. And I ended up, I have a number of friends who have gone through what's called the ISA, the Instituto Superior de Arte, which is their basically one of the main art school in Havana, if not in the country. And it's built on an old country club, like an old golf course, you know, and it was built as a kind of a Fidel Castro intended it as this utopian idea of just a school of the arts. So there's music, there's dance, there's theater, there's visual arts, and it's in the UNESCO site. The architecture is super interesting that they built there, but the work that's coming out of there is just so interesting. I've never taught anyone specifically about their, you know, how they approach their work, except that I will say that they are incredibly engaged with one another, with their work, with thinking about it, with contemporary issues. And what I was surprised about then is that there is a huge market there. Like when I was there in 2015, they literally had tour buses of art collectors coming to the ESA and mm-hmm. going to studios and buying stuff. So what I actually found, and this was so surprising to me, is that students in their early 20s were much savvier, much more professional than a lot of artists, mid-career artists I'd been to, like at Open Studios, Bushwick or whatever, where I walk into a studio and, you know, like, oh, tell me about this work or what's your price, you know, whatever. And they'd be like, oh, I don't have anything. I don't know. I have to, you know. I was like, whoa. These students had publications. I was so impressed with both the quality of the work that they were making and also their level of sophistication in terms of professionalism.
Right.
And I think part of it is because even though Cuba's been closed off to the United States for so many years, it hasn't been closed off to the rest of the world.
Right.
It holds an international biennial, which is more like a triennial or quarter, you know, like depending on funding, it's not always every 2 years. But, you know, so they're really active in the international art scene. Mm-hmm. So it opens them up. The flip side of it is Cuba's an extremely poor country, so
right.
getting art supplies is extremely difficult. So mm-hmm. What you also see is this ingenuity of like making work out of things that are out of non-traditional, what we would consider non-traditional art material.
Right.
Painting with concrete, you know, or cement, you know, doing those kinds of things that were just, I don't know, I found it super exciting.
Yeah. So that's a great point that Cuba, you know, while Cuba's been closed off from the U.S. for so long, it hasn't been closed off from the rest of the world. But what about just the phenomena of being stuck in the 50s for a long time? Was that, to what extent, did that start to change with the Obama administration?
I push back on that because Cuba I don't think Cuba's changed like every other country in the world. It's changed. Mm-hmm. It just mm-hmm. hasn't changed the way we have. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in terms of communications, Cubans only have been able to have like internet content on their phones in December 2018. So until then, they had to go to a Wi-Fi hotspot, and Wi-Fi hotspots only came into being in the, you know, around 2015 or something, 14, 13, like, you know, so like they've been very slow to come, you know, in terms of being able to have internet access. However, they're consistently on the forefront of medicine and all these other areas. And the society has evolved just very differently than ours has.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, if you go to Cuba, you will see, like, you'll think you're walking into the 50s from the cars and everything
right.
else. But if you start looking at people, absolutely not.
Right.
You know, so it's a good check for me on my own ideas, even though I've been going to Cuba since I was 13, of like, mm-hmm. you know, just being reinforced that like, this is a culture that's evolved on its own way that I need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about them understanding me. I need to open myself up.
Mm-hmm. What has your dynamic though been, particularly in longer stints there with the artists? I mean, you've integrated yourself. Have you integrated yourself into, or have they let you integrate yourself into the community to some extent?
Yeah. The wonderful thing about an island of 11 million people is that it's, you know, it's not a, I mean, it, the whole island's population is, you know, what, New York has a population of 8 million, so it's really not that much bigger than New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So people are just very gracious and generous and with their time, and they're, you know, people want to have conversations. And so mm-hmm. it's been in some ways a very easy way to like connect with people. So I really have enjoyed meeting other artists, but it's also really been lovely to meet, you know, people who are like directors of museums are actually also accessible. I was introduced to the director of the National Museum there, you know, someone like, you know, the head of the Met, right? Like, how would I ever meet the head of the Met? You know,
right.
But like, and the reason I met him was because of my electrician is a good friend of his. So like the hierarchy there is in some ways very flat.
Right.
So it's just like, if you're an interesting, nice person, oh, you should meet so-and-so. There isn't this kind of weird hierarchy that we have here of like, oh, you know, I'm not invited to the right cocktail party or something.
Yeah, that's got to be, you know, give you a whiplash, you know, when you're in Cuba for a bit and you go back to New York.
Yeah, it's kind of like, oh, okay, now I'm in a different system.